Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture. How'd you bounce back after hitting rock bottom? One man did that and more, both turning his life around and creating a viral enterprise, attracting customers from all over the world. Joining me today on All About Business is Matthew Jones, the founder and CEO of Bread Ahead, an international bakery made famous, among other things, by its scrumptious creme brulee donut. In this episode, we discuss Matthew's recipe for success, how to bounce back when everything falls apart, and how he built an international franchise from scratch. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Matthew Jones, head baker and founder of Bread Ahead. And in front of me, for those who can't see, who aren't watching on YouTube, we have some amazing donuts that I've just picked up from Bread Ahead in Borough Market. And these are unlike, I have to say, Matthew, unlike any donuts I've actually ever seen. I mean, they're fantastic. Also unique, I think. And you have been, I believe, described as the donut king. So can you tell us a little bit about what we're looking at here and why people are queuing up outside your bakery in such huge numbers, as I just witnessed?
Yeah, lovely to, well, thanks for having me. It's great. And it's always lovely to be, you know, in the room with donuts when I'm talking about the business, because they really help me sort of to connect with what we do. So I guess really, well, my background, I was a chef. I was a restaurant chef. I worked in the Michelin world from really when I left school. So I've always been in the food industry. I love cooking. I love baking. And started off as a restaurant chef and then sort of meandered my way through the kitchens of London in the 90s, in the noughties. And then ended up in pastry and then bakery. And I opened Bread Ahead in 2013. And the donuts have become a thing. You know, they
really... I can see why. Yeah. Did you know that when you started? I mean, did you want to make them? So what happened? How did that happen?
So we were merrily baking away. First day we made donuts, we made 60, put them outside at Borough Market, and they just sold. They just sold. You know, there was just... It was like giving sweets to children. You know, and then the next day we made 80, the next day we made 100. I can remember the first time we made over 1,000. And at the time that was back in 2014. And it was like the ceiling was coming in, you know, like 1,000. And then we made 2,000. And
just selling them in one day from Borough Market.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you up to? How many do you make a day now? Oh,
it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, that's nice. It's exciting. I like that story.
So our all-time record is currently 4,612 donuts in one day.
So was that a particular time of year? Is there a donut day?
It was actually donut week, yeah.
It was the donut week. When's that?
The National Donut Week.
It was donut week. When is this?
5 or 6 weeks ago.
Oh, right. I missed it.
We smashed it.
Did you? Okay. National Donut Week, everyone. Yeah. That's one to look out for. So just to share my experience with you, I went to Borough Market. We're talking to each other in the afternoon. I went there at lunchtime. Mm. It's heaving with people. It's really busy at this time of year in the summer. You walk into Borough Market and you can see your Bread Ahead outlets, bakery, pretty much from everywhere in the market. It's very prominent. You've got a great location, I observed. But a couple of things surprised me. One is that all the sales seem to be happening in the street, not inside, today at least. And people were queuing up on one side for bread and one side for donuts specifically.
Yep.
And the process was really efficient. But when I looked at the donuts, I've never seen a range. I saw from afar that it said creme brulee. I thought that was going to be a pudding, but actually it's a kind of donut.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're the creator of these. Just talk us through, what is there in your sort of donut portfolio that people like and which do they like the most?
Okay, so it started off with four flavors. We had chocolate, vanilla, caramel, and jam. So that's how we started.
And jam's just sort of regular old school donut.
Homemade, we make it with fresh raspberries, make it from scratch. I mean, we make everything from scratch. So caramel made from scratch. You know, we make all the creme patissiere ourselves. So we started with four flavors when we opened in 2013, and we kind of sat on that for years, to be honest. Probably 3 or 4 years, we just sat on those four flavors. And then we kind of started to experiment a little bit. We introduced pistachio, then we did lemon curd, then we did a blackcurrant cheesecake. And we've just grown it over the years. The most recent addition has been the creme brulee donut. And that has taken us to a completely different level altogether. It's actually half of our sales is that one product now.
Please say I bought two of them. It is. I'll take one home with me.
And it's just almost like, you know, we keep thinking we've kind of reached the peak, and we think we're going to plateau out, and we don't. We just keep peaking. It just keeps peaking.
That's interesting to hear. So you've sort of evolved by experimentation, it sounds. But the other thing I noticed, I mean, it's a very efficient process you've got there, very good location. It's really well branded, you can see. But they're not cheap. I mean, I paid £54 for 12 donuts, but they're like a meal in themselves. Yeah. So £4.50 for a donut. It's a different proposition altogether than what you might get at a service station or
if you're totally. Yeah.
So you must have been quite brave in going and positioning your product in the first place.
Yeah.
Quite so far away from what people might expect, I'm thinking. I don't know.
Yeah, it's outside the box. It's a food experience. It's not just a donut. You know, this is something you're going to eat. And you're going to remember that, you know, it's going to take you on a journey, and it's going to kind of push little buttons inside you that you may or may not be aware that you had, you know, it just sort of really does take you to another place. It's a journey. And we have people, I mean, just today in the queue at Borough Market, there will be people from all over the world. There'll be people from Mexico, from the States, from Japan, from, you know, you name it. There will be literally all over the world come to see us.
And that's because your reputation is now worldwide.
It's sort of gone bonkers.
So it's a food experience. And was that very much your initial intention?
Absolutely, yes.
You went out with that in mind.
Yeah, we want to create flavors that take you on a journey. You know, if you look at flavor as a bandwidth, and, you know, normal food, as we say, you know, sort of a normal sandwich has got quite a narrow bandwidth. It's sort of, you know, quite boring, really. You know, but we take you out there. You know, we go to the highs and the lows of sweetness and sour, and we really take you kind of outside your comfort zone a little bit and then put you back in again.
Well, what does that mean in food terms, going outside your comfort zone?
If it's acidic, it's got to be really acidic. If it's lemon, it's got to be really lemony. If it's a caramel, that's a really dark adult caramel, right on the edge of the palate.
So you really taste it.
Yeah.
Okay, so
the sort of flavor.
There's a real strategy here.
Yes, yeah. You've got to. Well, the thing is with flavors, you don't just want that sort of initial hit. You obviously want the initial hit, but then you want a kind of a secondary flavor that stays with you 45 minutes later, an hour later, the next day, that you're still thinking about. Yeah, you're still thinking about it.
Right. So you're getting into people's heads in a number of ways there. Not just the mouth, it's the mind.
It's a deep journey.
It's the mind, a deep journey. You've used that word journey, and business and growing a business is also a journey. So,
yeah. It's been extraordinary. I mean, you know, I started my life as a chef. Yeah, I was pretty chaotic as a youngster, really. And all I really knew was how to get into work, how to get my apron on, and how to just behave myself in a kitchen, you know. And
right, so let's go back to the beginning. So where did you start?
And
how did this journey begin?
So I was very fortunate. When I left school, or even while I was still at school, when I was 15, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a chef. I wanted to work in the restaurant. I'd read Down and Out in Paris and London, and I thought, that's
good
me.
Book. I've read that.
That's
like
me.
That.
I fit in
George
there.
Orwell. Mm.
Yeah, great. Good. You know, yeah. I fit in. Somehow I told myself that I'm going to fit into that world. So I'd already kind of made my mind up. I got my first job. It was a youth training scheme in Thackeray's House in Tunbridge Wells, which at the time was a brilliant restaurant. I was really lucky that I found, you know, my first experience as a real young man. I mean, a kid. I was 15.
So you started work at 15?
Yeah.
And the youth training scheme was a government scheme at the time to help young people get into work.
Yeah, £27 a week.
That's what you got paid, huh?
I had more money than I'd ever had in my life. It's all relative, I suppose. Yeah. Spent every penny of it. But it was an amazing environment to learn in. It was the first time I'd seen fresh foie gras, good quality herbs. Turbot came in on the boat. You know, all the fish came in on the bone. Guinea fowl came in with the feathers on. It was a proper restaurant. And the chef there and the team were amazing. It was, you know, this was in 1986. It was when the Good Food Guide was around. The food scene in London, in the UK, was kind of really small. you know.
Nothing like today. I was around then, I remember it. So
you know, it was a cheese sandwich, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A pub. You know, it was so basic and so undeveloped. And I was very fortunate to step into a career that was in an industry that was just about to go on an incredible journey.
We're delighted that you're listening to this episode. Hit the follow button so that we can continue to bring you the best business insight and actionable advice to help your business and or career.
What was it that set it alight, so to speak, or got that journey for the industry as a whole? What changed back then?
I think the Brits kind of woke up.
Enough had been a broad thing. Why do I have to eat like this?
We started traveling. You know, I can remember the first time going to France with my parents and having like a baguette, a fresh baguette. And it's like, we'd had nothing like that, you know? Even the fruit and veg that you get in, you know, south of France, it was just completely different, you know? And it was just extraordinary, really. From there, working in Thackeray's, I embarked on a career as a chef for 15 years. And that's what you did.
Sounds to me like you worked in pretty top establishments. Yeah, you said Michelin.
Yeah, Michelin World, you know, two-star Michelin, you know, the best at the time, Gidley Park Hotel with Sean Hill. Then I went to Bibendum with Simon Hopkinson.
Bibendum in South Kensington, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, I was there for 2 years. Loved it. And it was a great team of chefs there. I know them all still now, you know, we're all sort of in touch. And it was just a really tightly knit community in London of, you know, chefs. I mean, at the time you had Alistair Little, you had Rolly Lee, you had Sally Clark, you know, that was...
She's still going strong.
Yep.
That, I love
that
restaurant.
That was kind of it, you know.
Sally Clark's restaurant in Kensington Show Street. It's brilliant.
It stood the test of time.
40 years she's celebrating this year. So, yeah. So that goes back to the 85.
But I think what was really, you know, the real thing for me was when I worked in Bibendum and with, you know, Terence Conran, who was, he was an extraordinary, you know, and a visionary, you know, because it was not
only... He opened
only,
lots of restaurants at that time, didn't he? That was a big deal.
He changed the scene.
Right.
You know, he really
so
changed
partly
the London
people
scene.
Wanting more variety and partly Terence Conran, you'd say.
Yeah, he was...
And some pioneering chefs.
Yeah. But Terence was a huge... player, you know, he sort of brought that modern bistro cooking, you know, high-end bistro cooking really to London with Quaglino's, Le Pont de la Tour.
Yeah.
I worked in those places, absolutely loved it. You know, it was just nonstop. It was just 24/7. You know, London at that time in the 80s and the 90s was just electric.
Right. So that was a really good foundational experience.
Yeah.
And so at some stage you must have started thinking, maybe I'm going to start my own place. Or did you think about starting a restaurant? I mean, because you sort of branched out in a slightly different direction from what you'd been in.
Yeah, I always had two jobs. Even when I was working in the restaurant, you know, I always had jobs on my days off doing part-time work, anything.
Other restaurant?
Yeah.
Oh, so you just love what you do.
Working for friends, doing sort of dinner parties, anything I could. I always just, you know, wanted to make money and just wanted to work as much as possible. Whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know, but that was my journey.
It suggests you love your work.
Yeah, I do. I love it. Yeah.
Love
cooking.
I think that's really important.
I love being busy.
I love Monday's message. It's all about that. You know, finding something you love.
And then I ended up really in pastry, being a pastry chef in the restaurants, because really nobody else could do it. You know, it was just a sort of a corner of the restaurant kitchen.
Nobody else could do it.
Yeah. Nobody was really interested in it.
Really?
And I just liked it.
People like eating puddings and pastries.
I like bread. I love pastry. I love bread. I love British desserts, you know, good bread and butter pudding, good crumble.
So do I.
Good syllabub.
You know, you like cooking them or do you just like eating them as well?
All of it.
All of it.
Yeah, the whole process.
I like the whole.
I love the cleanliness of working with patisserie. Then when I was working at Mezzo Bakery, which was a Conran venture, I ran the bakery there. They had a separate standalone bakery. That was in
Where was that?
Border Street,
right.
1997, 1998. And it was a standalone bakery. And while I was working there, we made all the bread for the restaurants and I started supplying local restaurants. I thought, oh, this would be a good venture. So I got talking to the guys at Neil's Yard Dairy Shop. We started supplying people like Zilly Fish at the time and Pont Street Deli, I can remember, all sorts really. And that really got me thinking. I thought, God, this is an amazing business. You know, I could just have a little bakery somewhere and then I could start supplying people. and that would be my business, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, so business to business.
Pretty much B2B. While I was at Metso, I got into a conversation with the guys at Neil's Yard Dairy, and they told me about this thing called Borough Market that was being developed in 1998.
Oh, right. Was that when it was?
Yeah. That's when it was a fruit and veg market in the nights, and a bunch of people had got together and did once a quarter. It was Randolph from Neil's Yard Dairy. It was Henrietta Green. They got together and they organised a food fair down at Borough.
Once a quarter,
yeah.
Right.
And they said, "Why don't you come along, bring some bread and see how it goes? Bring a table." And I was like, "Yeah, all right. Yeah, let's see what this looks like." So I duly did. And actually outside Neil's Yard Dairy shop in 1998, so it's pitched up with a table that's smaller than this table here, probably 6 foot across. Just put a load of bread on it. How does this work? Okay, so 4 pounds sourdough. Yep. Olive bread. Yep. Great. You know, sold everything I took there they just had the right audience. They had people who got it. You know, there was, you know, they wanted sourdough. They wanted decent cheeses.
They wanted artisan type produce.
And that was the beginning of Borough Market. And I was like, wow, that was incredible, you know.
So you'd found your home in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that really was the pivotal moment. I thought, I'm going to do this for myself. I'm going to look for a premises.
Yeah.
And set up shop.
So I was thinking the location is pretty important for this. I mean, you've got a really sort of receptive audience there.
Yeah. So that was my first business venture before Bread Ahead. This was, when I was a youngster.
Right.
So I had this idea and I thought I'm going to design.
So what was that called?
It was called Flower Power City.
Right. Okay.
And it was,
You like rhyming names?
Yeah. Yeah. It just sounded good. And I don't know where the name came from, really. It just sort of Flower Power. I guess I was a bit of a hippie and, I thought, let's do a bakery.
It was spelled F-L-O-U-R.
Yeah.
Though. Yeah. Okay.
And it ripped. I mean, I opened on my own, literally on my own with some flour and, nothing, like 500 quid and a wing and a prayer, really.
Were you getting up at sort of 3 a.m. to do
24/7.
So you're working really hard.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that should be overstated overlooked, rather.
If I do a new venture.
Sleep on the floor.
I will sleep on the floor. I will literally live in that place until the business works. It is.
So you've done that more than once?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've done that twice.
When you say about how many days in a row are you sleeping on the floor?
I've been through this journey twice.
So Flower Power was the first.
Flower Power.
And then Bread Ahead was the second, wasn't it?
Was the second.
And on both occasions, you slept on the floor.
On both occasions, I started from a very, very rock bottom. We'll come to that. So Flower Power was a success. It was really good. Like a month down the line, I employed a couple of bakers. I grew, started supplying restaurants around, and then Borough Market was once a quarter at this stage. Back in 1999, this would have been. So once a quarter only, It was brilliant. We'd turn up there, take a load of money. It was really, really good. And then some other markets started opening in London, like farmers markets. So I started doing those. I employed more staff. I saved up some money. Then I moved premises to a big industrial warehouse unit down near Millwall.
Right.
And things went really well. All good. Grew the business, kept growing. I was in my mid-30s. And it was, which seems, it's funny really to talk about it because my life now is so different, actually.
Yeah.
But I was a pretty chaotic character.
So what happened then?
Through that journey, I mean, the bit that I haven't gone through is, as much as I have my lovely cup of tea in front of me now, my companion at the time was not tea. It was booze,
Right.
And I was a very frequent drinker.
Right.
With no off button.
So you were sort of drinking all the time?
Yeah.
And I suppose that can happen when you work in restaurants and that world, I guess. It can happen anywhere, can't
people
it?
To alcoholics.
So you discovered at that point that you didn't have an off button.
I did not have an off button, but somehow I made it work, I just through brute force, really.
Right.
I was just so driven and so sort of single-minded about making it work, that I would make it work. But God, I made my life hard. You know, I really made my own life hard.
So what, the drinking?
Oh, some
people think, you know, the addictions, you move from one, but so work can be an addiction as well.
I think it can. Yeah, exercise can. Yeah, sure. Many things can. Yeah, but
at that point you had this issue.
But they're probably not quite so destructive.
No.
You know? So I kind of managed, you know, I kind of managed my life, was successful. You know, I had probably 80 staff, you know, turning over a lot of money, big business, great. And then the wheels started to come off.
Right.
You know, I was kind of, I was in my late 30s, sort of thought, great, this is just amazing. You know, I've got my business, I've got everything. And then I got approached by an investor.
Right.
I thought, well, this could be really great. You know, he was very flattering. And I got sucked in and I thought, yeah, this is the right thing to do. I'm going to take it.
Was this an individual or a company?
Yeah, individual. Yeah.
Right.
LJ.
Right. Shall we
Let's
say.
Call him LJ.
So him called LJ. Yeah, LJ came
and
in. Yeah.
Who's a serial entrepreneur and a very extraordinarily successful man. And, you know, I have nothing but respect for, to be honest. And, and he duly invested in the business. And the beginning was great. It was fine. Yeah. And then he sort of got wind that there was something wrong with Matthew. You know, it's like this guy's turning up to meetings late, drunk, whatever, you know, it's like.
Oh, I see. So he was aware of
he was having none of it. He was having absolutely none of it. So he sacked me from my own business.
Okay. I think I know this LJ. I might even call him a friend, but yeah. So he sacked you from your own business.
And he sacked me from my own business and my life fell apart. And it was.
So he must have had a majority share then at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. So you sold out some shares to him.
And I was just so compromised. Yeah. And right. I was just in no fit state to run a business.
Mm.
I was ruined.
Yeah.
I was broken. I was absolutely broken. I honestly, it was just like being in this corner and suddenly I realized that I'd kind of lost. You know what I mean? And being. You know, for a very determined person who's focused on business, had a great career, and suddenly at the age of like 39,
right,
being in this position when you finally realize that you have just lost everything. And that was like, you know, I mean, I had so houses.
Really, as they call it, say rock bottom.
Yeah, brutal. It was absolutely brutal. Yeah. I mean, I had nothing but debts and I, you know, it was just horrendous. And so I packed my bags, well, a bag, because that's all I had. And I went to see a mate of mine who lived up, who's got a farm in Northfield Farm. It's in Oakham, up in Leicester.
Right.
And Jan's a really good mate. And he just took a look at me and he said, Matthew, you're like yellow. You're just ill. You're just, you can't go on. You need to stop. Right. You're going to die.
Yeah.
And funny enough, at that time, his friend.
So yellow goes with sort of liver failure, doesn't
yeah.
it? Jaundice.
I'd been hospitalized. I had alcoholic pancreatitis. I mean, I was on death's door.
Right.
And
39.
Yeah. I was like really like fat around my neck. I've got this old photo somewhere of myself. And it's just like, you know.
Right.
And everything fell apart. Marriage, family, everything. And so I went to stay with Jan for a weekend. But Jan's farm was staying Clarissa Dixon Wright, who's a recovering alcoholic. And she sort of had a chat with me and just said, why don't you come along to one of these meetings I go to? So we might find that quite useful. And I did. And really, that's really when my life started. And it was extraordinary. So I ended up staying in Jan's spare bedroom for 9 months. I didn't go back to London and made myself busy on the farm.
So you helped on the farm?
Yep. And then we had a little tea house there. So we started doing some baking.
And you stopped drinking at this point?
Yeah,
you
just stopped.
So you just managed to switch.
Literally
it off.
One day to the next. Right. The moment I stepped foot on that farm, that was it.
Right.
And I realized, you know, so it was.
That's been the case since.
Yeah. I haven't touched a drop in 15 years. I've been sober for,
fantastic.
Which is it's
that's
quite
fantastic.
Extraordinary to say it really.
And that's anyway. Clarissa Dixon, right?
Oh, but she's died. She's dead. She died a few years ago.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
But she really did help me on my way, good old Clarissa. Yeah. But yeah, so then it was during that time, I was sitting up at Jan's table in his kitchen. And the first thing I thought, you know, I got my head clear and I thought, right, I better sort this out because I think I've got another chance. I've got it in me. You know, I can do this again.
Yes.
I can. I'm going to do this again.
Well, yeah, I'm not going back. You've got another opportunity.
Yeah, I'm not going to go and be a pastry chef again in a kitchen in a Michelin world. I'm not going to do that. So somehow, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I'm going to open a new business. Where'd you start with that?
Well, that's a good book. That'd be my next question, Matthew. Where'd you start?
So I started at the beginning.
Have you got any money?
No, I had debt and revenue.
So where do you start? You've decided you want to do this. You're starting from a tough place.
Yeah, piece of paper.
We start with a piece of paper.
So then I drew this word bread. I've still got the book at home. I've got my little notebook. Yeah. I love sketching and drawing, and I do that a lot still. And I wrote down the word bread, and then I drew a little arrow after it. And I thought, just bread ahead. That's the name. That's going to be the name of the business.
So you drew a piece of bread with an arrow, and that became bread ahead.
Yeah.
That just came out of nowhere.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere.
I love that. I've heard that before. We've talked to other people about where's your brand come from. Yeah. They have this sort of moment where they just decide what
and,
it is.
Yeah.
So that was that. So you had your brand. So you knew you were going to do something with bread and it was going to be forward looking.
And then I thought, you know, one thing I really want to focus on is education because I just like to teach people stuff. You know, I just really like to have people in the room showing people how to make bread. And I think I find it quite healing really to have people just around a table and talk to them about making bread. So I started thinking, right, I'm gonna do this. So this was like 6 months into being at Jan's place. And a friend of mine, Olivier, who used to work for me, he wanted to also set up his own bakery.
Mm.
So he was a great guy. Olivier's smart. He's, you know, young French guy. And he found a premises in Bermondsey that was a disused bakery. So I thought, great, Olivier, what I'll do, I'll give you a hand to open up and I'll bake some bread in your place. Sleep on the floor. So I'll come back to London, basically. And then I'll take my bread to Borough Market and I'll sell it on a market stall under Bread Ahead. This is Bread Ahead now. New name. It was a two years between Flower Power and Bread Ahead. And, you know, Borough Market knew me. I knew them well, had me back. Yeah, happy to have you back. You're doing a new venture. Great, great to see you. Oh, you actually, you look a bit better, Matthew, actually. You're not spending the entire time in the pub. Yeah.
The pub must have been disappointed, but everyone else was pleased.
And it was actually really nerve-wracking. I remember the first time, it's a really strange thing. If there's any listeners out there, you know, because there probably will be. It's really weird, right, when you're in early recovery, like being back in the same environment because you feel really vulnerable.
I bet, yeah.
And it's funny, you know, and then...
Because you used to go into that pub and you'd have people you knew who'd drink with.
Can you trust yourself to be near that? And I just found the courage to do it, really, and I did. Before I knew it, I got myself a little flat back in London. And Olivier was, you know, I was baking my stuff there, taking
the
Borough Market.
So is Olivier your business partner?
No, he's got his own business.
So he has his business and you were using his bakery to make your bread.
Yeah. It was kind of a temporary solution until you got your own one. Back on my feet.
So he was a supplier in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I still get on with him now. And, you know, Olivier, we used to go drinking together. I mean, God, you know, it was, and, you know, we've both grown up, you know.
Right.
Big time.
You have coffee together now and stuff.
Yeah, a cup of tea, you know.
Yeah.
So then I eventually found the space in Borough Market, where we are now, actually. It came available and I converted
that.
That's
a great space, isn't it? So you must have been pretty pleased when you saw that. What was it before?
It was just storage of fruit and veg, potatoes and carrots and onions.
Because it's very immediately visible.
Yeah. Well, when we moved there, it really wasn't. I mean, the market, like, you know, 13 years ago now, 12, 13 years ago, the market was actually much quieter. So especially during the week, the sort of Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday were pretty, you know, tumbleweed down there. The Saturdays were always big.
Yeah. It's not like that now, is it?
Oh, God, it's just so busy.
It's a huge destination now.
You're massive, international, you know.
Yeah, so you really landed in the right place.
Yeah. And it's been the heart of the business, really, ever since we opened. So we opened, originally we were selling bread on the market stall. Mm. And then about 6 months after we opened in Borough, we started doing the bakery courses.
Your school, because you have a bakery and a school.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a big thing. I mean, the school has grown.
You said you'd like to teach.
So. Yeah. So we ran short courses, 3 hours, like workshops, really designed for the home baker that wanted to improve their skills.
Right.
Before you know it, we started doing little school groups, which was really nice to have, like, you know, sort of 14, 15-year-olds in. And I found myself talking to them about my career path, you know, about, you know, I was so fortunate, really, when I was at school. I just knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that was really rewarding. That really sort of helped me, you know, to on my journey with baking and bread. And then we just grew and Borough just got busier and busier. We employed more people. I mean, I used to be in the bakery 24/7. I was the first probably 5 years.
So you slept there a lot.
When I had a flat, I literally next to the bakery.
Right.
And my life used to consist of a little triangle that went between my flat, the bakery, and Monmouth Coffee. Right. And that was it. That's what I did for like a couple of years.
Yeah. So this is a really big commitment, a huge effort.
Yeah.
You put
I mean, I built the business 100% from cash flow. No loans. No partners, no debt.
No loans, no partners, no debt.
Nothing, no. And it's still the same today.
So you wholly own it.
Yep.
You've got the shares with your wife. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's from cash inflow investment.
Yeah. Reinvesting.
Revenue
everything.
Investment, we call it in Reed. That's how we've grown our business.
Well, it's a real business, you know, and I think that's real. And we had a couple of sort of real milestone events, I suppose, on the way. You know, we were always recognized for doing sort of profoundly good food because we do, you know, I mean, that's my background. I mean, I was came from the Michelin world. So it was all about flavor and do it properly or don't bother sort of thing, really, you know, simple range, you know, we don't do too many things, probably 12 real key products. We do viennoiserie, sourdough bread and donuts and the teaching. We opened a couple of locations in sort of 2017, 2018. We opened on Pavilion Road in Chelsea. That was it's been very, very good for us. We opened in Wembley. We opened a really big bakery up there.
How's that?
It's amazing.
Wembley's actually like a new city.
Yeah.
All around the stadium, all those new flats.
Yeah.
It's a huge area, isn't it?
And I think we've been very fortunate.
So how many outlets have you got now?
Five now in London.
Five.
South Kensington, one in Bromley. But we've been in a very fortunate position that generally we've been helped by landlords. So the landlords have given us, you know, incentivized us to move there, given us capital contribution.
They like you being there because it brings people into there.
Yeah.
Neighborhood, I suppose.
Well, we're
the smell
quality
of baking
brand.
Is good as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and we bake on site. It's proper baking. We don't have a freezer. We don't freeze things at all. And we've kept it very natural and real.
But I understand you're also setting up outside of the UK. Is that right?
So
I've heard this, but tell me more. What are you doing?
What a journey. So, you know, it's sort of gives me goosebumps really to talk about it. But, you know, it always became apparent when we were down at Borough Market that we had a following, you know, from far and wide. You know, people
from all over the
up,
world coming.
Yeah, you know, from America would sort of rock up and say, hey, you know, I'm not going to try and do an accent because I'm terrible. But, you know, and they'd say, hey, you guys, you're really, you know, we've seen you on Instagram or TikTok or whatever. And they would just love our stuff, you know. So during COVID. Now, COVID, I mean, that's a whole chapter of a book in itself. COVID was just this all over the place thing for us. We just opened Wembley, our biggest site. We'd gone massively over budget. We had to find literally overnight a ton of money that we didn't have. We had to refund 6 months' bookings for the school in advance.
Because you couldn't deliver the courses.
No,
so people
had
paid and you had to send the money back.
Send it back.
You couldn't do it virtually for that.
No. We did some, there was a lot of love around. So, you know, a lot of forgiveness and, you know, but I think just, you know, the first kind of couple of months of COVID, nobody knew what the hell was going on. We didn't think it was going to last for 2 years.
No, I remember it. Yeah, I was in exactly the same situation. You
know, we were thinking, oh, this is going to be.
What are we going to do next?
Yeah, we'll be, by the summer, this will be out of the way. No chance. But it ended up being really good. We ended up being busier than ever because we were kind of the only thing open. We didn't close for one day.
You kept your bakeries open?
Yeah, I kept everything open.
Did you?
Yeah, because I love being open.
So what you just said, because I suppose you're a food supplier.
Yeah, essential.
There was no rules saying you had to close.
Yeah, bread was huge. Yeah. We were posting flour out. We were doing online classes. Our Instagram went crazy. Went from like 60,000 followers to 200,000 in 6 weeks. We developed the online platform for teaching baking, which is something we'd always wanted to do, but just said we're too busy. So we had to, so we did.
So you mentioned Instagram twice. So tell me, social media a big deal for
Massive.
You? Massive. So how does that work? And I think you do it yourself.
I do all of it myself.
You do all of it?
Yeah.
So what do you do?
I just go on Instagram. I make these silly little videos of myself talking about the product. Typically, I'll be down at Borough Market saying, "Hey, everybody, I'm just down on the bakery stall, I'm eating a donut and it's really delicious. Why don't you come down and have one?"
Right.
I keep it.
How often do you do that?
Every day. Yeah. And I don't edit anything.
A daily post?
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes six times a day, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I can really push it. And, you know, I like content that's really raw.
Right.
Because I like, you know, live music or opera and things, you know, because it's real.
Yeah. You don't sing on your Instagram?
No.
I just wanted to understand
Never.
That. So the opera's what you enjoy going to watch?
I do, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Right. You don't deliver a baker. Yeah. Oh, right. So that's become a big part of your marketing.
Yeah, huge, huge.
But you were saying, so you were aware that people were coming from all over the world to enjoy your donuts and bread. And then you thought, what, in terms of expansion?
Yeah.
You said you were on a journey that
We got approached by a family from the Middle East. So since then, we have opened in Dubai.
They're like a partner of yours?
Franchise partner, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We have.
Oh, so you've gone into franchising?
Yeah. Internationally, it's really the only way.
So they use all your branding?
Yeah. We train them. We send our guys, send a team out there.
And you get a cut of what they sell?
Yeah.
I'm interested in franchising.
It works really well. Yeah.
Does it in your space?
You've got to find the right partner, and we were lucky. We found the right people to do this, you know.
Because I remember years ago, I don't know whether I should dare mention them in this podcast, but Krispy Kreme, you know, they were doing franchising in the UK.
Well, I mean, they're
a huge company, aren't they?
Yeah, there's billions.
But they did franchising,
didn't they? It's the only way to scale at real sort of speed and growth. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a Krispy Kreme eater myself. But,
I didn't think you would be looking at your donut.
Yeah, kind of. It's pure sugar, isn't it? But it's not real flavor.
No. That's why I didn't really want to mention them. But I only mentioned them in the context of franchising because they obviously did that quite successfully.
Oh, very. I mean, they kind of, yeah.
So you see that as a strategy for you. So are you looking for other potential franchise?
Would
a benefit of this discussion be if you're interested in becoming a Bread Ahead franchise?
Send me an email.
Contact. So if you want to be a Bread Ahead franchise, who do you contact?
You just send matthew@breadahead.com an email and say, hey. But it's,
why not? Actually, I can see that that could be a good living. You know, you have a good business being a Bread Ahead franchise somewhere.
Yes, yes, you do. Yeah, there's good margin in the product. And it's, you know, it's funny to say that really, but it's, you know, we're looking for the sort of people who are passionate about our business. That's what's really important. You don't want somebody who's just thinking about how much profit can I make from this.
But people who love baking and the things that you like, I imagine.
They need to share the values, yeah.
Yeah. So do you have sort of defined values? I mean,
people
know what they are in the business?
Yeah, but I think...
What are they? What?
I think it's just a love of natural food.
Is that what you say?
You know, a good sourdough baking.
Mm.
And I think, you know, well, since then we've actually got a partner in Philippines. So we're opening in Manila this year in September.
So that's another franchise.
Yeah, which is a big thing for us, actually. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you could end up with a lot of these.
Thousands.
Thousands. Is that the ambition?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I would like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All around the world.
Yeah, and it's really exciting because, I mean, the thing I love is I love traveling and I've traveled extensively. It's really nice to be, you know, to go to a place, to a city and to not be a tourist, to actually have a business there.
Yes.
It's so relatable. And you just have a really different relationship with the city and the people who live there. But, you know, it's such a transferable skill. I mean, I would love to be, you know, especially the bakery school part of it, because people already come to us from all over the world. So it's very easy for us to set up a bakery school in, you know.
You kind of know you've got customers in these, yeah, in these geographies because they're coming to you already.
Is but it's so, saying? You know, from Mexico City to Tokyo to, you know, it's a... Baking is a global phenomenon.
Do you do franchises in the UK as well, or are you sticking
no,
to...
No, I don't think, you know, the UK, we just do it ourselves.
Do it yourselves. So the strategy would be to do it yourselves in the UK and franchises outside.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's, you know...
So you've got the Middle East. Where in the Middle East are you going?
Right Dubai, across. You mentioned. So we open in Saudi, in Dubai.
Next so they're already open?
Yeah, they're open. We have 11 bakeries there.
11 in Saudi?
Yeah. Really? Saudi and Dubai, right. UAE. Next will be Egypt.
Right.
Yeah, huge foodie communities in these countries.
Yeah, I bet.
And it's, yeah, there's so much.
So have you been out to Saudi?
Yeah, I go all the time, yeah.
So
I was there back in March, yeah.
Right. Is the audience the same? I mean, do they like to eat the same things?
Some people we see in Borough Market. It's the same
people.
It is.
And is it the same products, I suppose, I'm asking?
Same.
So that's brilliant.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And then likewise, when I'm in the bakery in Chelsea, I'll see guys, oh yeah, I saw you in Jeddah, you know, and the world has become such a, you know, it's so much smaller now, isn't it really?
Well, that's very interesting though, because you're establishing a brand online in a sense through your social media, TikTok, Instagram, and then you're repeating it in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what it is and what they can get. And it's very immediately recognizable and distinctive, isn't it?
But I think the world is ready for new brands. I mean, if you look at, you know, in my childhood, there was, you know, there was McDonald's and there was KFC and there was, you know, and I mean, it's not great, is it? You know, there's, you know, I mean, I know they serve a purpose and...
I've been around a long time and, yeah.
Yeah, but I think
it's nice to go somewhere else.
I think there's time. I think it's just that I think the market's ripe for new brands, for... You know, if you think of companies like Arabica Coffee, you know, who from Japan, I mean, they're an amazing brand, really focused on what they do, really successful.
So the world is ready for new brands. You're creating one. I mean, you've created one. You're creating one that is growing fantastically. What sort of advice would you give to someone who's thinking, who's got their piece of paper like you had a few years back, just starting to write something on it, how to think about a new brand or a new position in a market? If you wanted to start out as a young entrepreneur or indeed a middle-aged entrepreneur who wants to have another go, what would you suggest as a way, just a thought process really, any advice for people?
Yeah, it's a funny thing because, you know, when I was in the early stages of setting this up, did I think that we'd become a really big international business? No, I didn't. But I think most importantly, I learned from very good people. You know, when I was 15, 16 years old, I was in those kitchens, I was learning, and I gave 100% of myself to what I do. You know, if I was told to be at work at 6, I would be there at 5:30. I would be in there on my days off. I commit 100% to what I do.
It sounds like more than 100%, actually.
Yeah, that's not an easy thing to be around for, you know.
You mean as a colleague of yours?
I think for anybody, you know, because it's, you know, I'm the guy, I work 7 days a week. I have no issue with that. Would I want my guys to do that? No. I don't. So we sort of live in this quite hypocritical world, really. I think people who are pioneering in businesses, because what they say and what they do or their expectations of others can be at times quite unreasonable. And I've got
to... What do you mean? Hypocritical,
well, you know, because I wouldn't want anybody to work 7 days a week for me. I'd actually be annoyed. I'd be angry with myself. But somehow I'm prepared to abuse myself almost to do that.
It doesn't feel like abuse to you, though.
No, it feels
that's
completely
why you do
natural.
Because you like it. You're enjoying it.
I love it.
Well, that's what I can say. That's what I'm sensing.
Love.
So
every,
why would you stop doing something you love? Because it's all seventh day or
precisely.
Something.
Precisely. I mean, but it's, you know, I wouldn't want other people to do that because I would feel that it's wrong. But, you know, every single day I get up, I'm looking forward to going into work. I look forward to it. And I think partly is that because not a day goes past when I don't remember what I had, what I lost. And that was brutal. I mean,
in terms of your previous flower power.
Yeah, because it's not only losing the business, is it? You lose your confidence. You lose your, you know, you lose your family on the way. You lose, you know, you lose things that you will miss, big things.
Yeah.
And some of those things you can't get back. Some you can.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, that's hard. So when you are presented again with an opportunity, or I was, I took 100%, you know, of the opportunity. And I don't want to miss out on that because I know the value of it.
Well, that's a powerful message for everyone, you know, myself and everyone listening, because...
It's not often I share that, actually. I mean, no, I think it's been in that, in such an articulate way, but maybe this is just the right environment for that. So,
well, I'm really pleased you did, because, I mean, that's true of us all in life, in a sense. And but what you have had is it shown to you very starkly through what happened.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what I'm taking from your sort of, from your remarks.
It's very real. And it's much easier, I think, you know, when you've sort of crossed certain milestones in a business, you know, it's very difficult to sort of talk with confidence about things when you're 3 weeks sober, you know, and it's all really fresh because nobody really takes you seriously. But now people do, you know, and they take me seriously, which is really nice. And I've earned that, you know. So I suppose going back to your, you know, you said, what would you advise to a young entrepreneur? You've got to stick it out, that you don't get success on day one. But you've got to be resilient. And that doesn't matter if it's sport or if it's playing a musical instrument or if it's, you know, learning a craft, you've got to be prepared to do the 10,000 hours because this is what it takes and more.
My last guest on this podcast told me it took him 5 years to get his first sale.
Wow.
And he's got a fabulous business now and he's growing it all around the world. But I think that's I think that's almost a record, five years. But he really demonstrated what you just said.
Mm.
So, I mean, but this is, in a way I'm feeling you're here and he was here because you have this quality and unusual quantities, perhaps, you know, of being persistent and not quitting and sleeping on the floor. Where does that come from? When is it innate or... Where does that come from?
You know, I think when I grew up, I mean, I liked the world I grew up in. I was really, you know, born in 1969, great music scene, you know, the time of the Sex Pistols and the Clash and, you know, and it just all seemed so good.
Oh, you like them? Well, I like the Clash. I remember going to see them live. Oh, yeah, they were very good. Yeah.
It's wonderful, you know.
No, they were brilliant.
And so raw and so honest and just so... unapologetic, you know. And
so that gave you energy, did it?
It did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. And then just things, I suppose, my memories was things like my holidays with my parents were camping, you know. We slept on the floor. We made fires. We had our food from tin plate, you know, from tin cups. It was very, very basic. And I love that, you know. I love it.
Do you still go camping?
No.
Why not? Given how much you liked it, or your wife doesn't like it.
My wife would not put her foot into a tent.
Wouldn't she?
No.
I take my family camping a few times, but I haven't done it recently. You're making me think I'd like to do it again.
Yeah. I think, you know.
Just buying all the kits more expensive than staying in a hotel, though, now.
Yeah. Camping's really changed. I mean, back in the day, I think it was you know, important to be actually really uncomfortable and wet.
But you did all that and you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So what are you saying? That gave you a certain sort of resilience.
I think being prepared to sort of live with very little, you know. Yeah.
You didn't need much and you knew you could enjoy yourself and get on with it.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the lessons I learned about having to restart I didn't only restart business, I restarted my life. That was a thing, you know. And to do that, you've got to be, you know what it tastes like to have, you know, less than very little, you know.
But you did have a good friend, that chap, Jan.
Jan's a gem.
Yeah, and so it's important if people are feeling in that they're in a sort of crisis to think about who they can reach out to, I suppose. Because there will be people, I imagine, who come and... Yeah.
There's not very many.
No, but they will be. They're out there, but they're rare, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you really learn, you know. I remember somebody said to me when everything went wrong back in, it was 2009 was the year when my world caved in. And Somebody said to me, you'll find out who stands up and who sits down. You know, that's not very many people stand up.
Right.
Sadly. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one did at least.
But I really did take the piss. You know, I mean, I was...
Yeah.
I was totally...
Well, people aren't themselves in that situation.
No, I was unmanageable. You know, yeah. Totally. I mean, it was chaotic, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a funny thing because, you know, going back to the early days of Bread Ahead, you know, occasionally I'd sort of see an old customer from Flower, and they'd sort of look at me in this way that they were expecting me to be. and that stopped happening. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, that hasn't happened. You know, come on, I've been...
I know the new you.
No, I've been clean and sober for many years now. And, you know, I've become, I think, really quite a different person through that journey.
So do you mentor people and do support people in their journey?
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
do
I do.
Sobriety journey.
Yeah, I go to meetings. I have a lot of friends in recovery, a lot actually, pretty much most of my friends are actually in recovery. And,
right.
And it's quite a common thing in the chef world, you know?
Yeah, I imagine so.
You're either
one or the other, I suppose.
Well, either they're dead or they're in recovery.
In recovery, is that right? Yeah, because it's an extreme lifestyle.
Very. And I think it attracted a... You know, especially that sort of world, the Michelin world, it was almost glamorous to be sort of, you know, overtired and overworked. And, you know, it was all a bit silly, really.
Yeah.
And it did attract a certain type of...
Is it still like that?
No, it's really cleaned up. You know, it's become much more sort of human.
So it's different.
Yeah.
Different era.
Yeah. And, the laws have changed. You know, restaurants now have HR departments and they have to abide to the laws. You know, you can't make people work 70 hours a week.
Yeah. Yeah, no, quite. So what's next for you then? I mean, you're obviously expanding with the franchises.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to do with your school, which I think is a wonderful thing?
The most recent addition to the to Bread Ahead's, you know, educational side has really been the academy. So this is long in the making. Took us 6 years of sort of design, because it was always, you know, on the cards. We really wanted to design a program where young people can come in and learn, well, not really just young, anybody can come in and learn to be a baker. And not just a baker, but an artisan baker in our field, which is, you know, it's about sourdoughs, it's about natural yeasts, it's about viennoiserie, croissant. You know, it's a particular type of baking and it's really the one that's growing. That's the, you know, if you look at the successful bakeries in London, be it Dusty Knuckle or be it Toad or be it, you know, There's a bunch of us, and this is the stuff we do. You know, it's those sexy focaccias, the sourdough pizzas. That's our thing. You know, that's what we teach.
Are you just creating lots of future competitors doing that?
Oh, the market's so deep.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm not, fine
that
with
worry
that.
About, you know, no, you're no, fine it's fine. You're generous spirited.
Yeah, look, there's you know, I'm not going to own bakery worldwide. You know what I mean? No, it's not going to happen. No, you know,
there is... So if someone wants to go on your academy, it takes 6 months, is it? So for people listening, where do they go to sign up for that?
They send Chris an email, actually. Chris@breadahead.com. And they
Chris
say, hey, Chris, I'd love to be one of your new students. The chances are we'll end up employing them because they sort of...
So it's a great way to get a job as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. We give them real skills. 6 months. So got a really good teacher, Wygella, who is a gifted baker, comes also from a sort of chef background, so a foodie.
So many of the people signing up are school leavers, are they older
Bit
people?
Bit of a mix. I mean, we've got one girl at the moment who came actually over from California. She came over, moved to London. Yeah. So real mixture.
There's a very famous chef school in Ireland, isn't there?
Ballymaloe.
That's attached to a hotel And so many people have been there and trained there.
Well, that's how these
You're
things
creating
start.
That in the bakery world.
It's totally
I'm thinking.
That, you know.
And such a nice combination.
And I suppose the thing I've learned really is, you know, it's time in the market is really what's needed. Because, you know, even if you go back to the early days of something like Cordon Bleu, it would have been originally a couple of people in a room saying, hey, let's do some teaching. And it grows. And, you know, the really good businesses, I always think, grow organically. And they just, most importantly, is the substance is pure.
Yes. So the school and the bakery are sort of complementary in that sense.
Very much so.
And will grow organically.
Yeah.
In a way together, which is really powerful.
Yeah. And we, you know, the school side of it, it's, you know, it's quite informal, quite relaxed. I mean, the day-to-day classes we run are 3 hours. Yeah. for just individuals who come along. You know, it's Mr. and Mrs. Smith from Tunbridge Wells will come up for to make Italian baking lesson. You know, we do a lot of school groups, a lot, almost every day we do a school group, and they'll come in to make, you know, some bath buns or whatever. Yeah. We do corporate bookings. So that's a really big one for us. A lot of corporate, like team building groups.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's really good. Spend a day doing, you know, together. So if you're listening, if bring your office on a team building course.
So who do they email for that? Chris again?
No, that'll be Molly. Molly. Email Molly, because Molly is
we'll put all this in the show notes.
A demon, you know, she's...
Well, that would be a really fun sort of team building day. I can see that.
Yeah.
I think everyone would really enjoy
that. We have loads of... I'm not sure if I'm allowed to mention company names on here, but we have...
You can say what you like on here. Yeah, no, this is free speech corner.
Last week, we had IKEA, we had Bentley Motors, we had Soho House recently.
They're all coming in to do team building.
Yeah, they love it.
That's brilliant. I didn't know you did that.
It's huge. And they go away with big bags of product. It's really generous, you know, and just we have this nice, it's a lovely spirit we've created.
And is that in Wembley?
Wembley and Borough.
And Borough as well. So now I have to ask you this, because it's front page news on my City AM.
Oh,
we're in
yes.
London on City AM today. And as well as all these lovely donuts in front of me, the front story on City AM says Slim Pickings. And it says grocery sales fall as popularity of weight loss jab leads to fewer items in the bagging area. I mean, are tastes going to change as people take weight loss jabs or other?
Well, I mean, it's interesting for sure. I mean, that, you know, the Ozempic thing is, you know, I know three people are taking Ozempic. It's everywhere. It's so big. Has it affected our sales? No. We are.
So we're
growing.
The bagging area hasn't been affected at Bacon.
No, it has not at all.
So this might happen, but it's not. You're not seeing it yet.
No, but you know, I think
people eat slightly different things. That's all. Yeah,
I think we're still pretty much. We're quite a niche brand. I mean, we're typically the sort of a treat day. You know, we're something that people have once a month.
Yeah.
You know, we're not. You know, we're not on every corner.
No.
You know. So, I mean, we're still relatively a small business, you know, it's a, we have 5 locations in London. We have about 200 staff.
How many franchises are you at?
We have, 11 locations open in the Middle East. They'll open another 4 or 5 this year, and we're opening Philippines. So by the end of this year, we'll have probably 20.
20, so that's fast growing as well.
Yeah, but it's, you know, once it gets a grip, it can really grow very fast.
Yeah. So that's for the next year or two. That's a big focus.
It's
for
a big thing.
Yeah. Well, I wish you huge success with that. Thanks for coming and talking to me. Now, I'm going to ask you 2 questions, which I always ask at the end. You kind of half answered one, or more than half answered one, which is, what gets you up on a Monday morning? That's my first question.
Gosh. Well, I'm an early riser, so I'm just up, you know.
But what is an early riser in your world?
5. I'm one of those people, I get up early on holiday, you know.
Really?
So terrible.
Well, how early did you get up on holiday?
4 or 5.
Go
for a walk. Terrible. Yeah.
So you get up early because
I don't like to go for a walk around, go and have a cup of coffee, just sort of go through my emails,
see what's going
on, make some notes, sit down with my pen, you know.
So you've always been like that.
Like to connect. Yeah. I'm not one for snoozing. Yeah.
No, don't give me that impression.
No.
And then my last question is a question from my interview book, Why You, 101 Interview Questions You'll Never Fear Again. And it's very simple. It's, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Gosh, in 5 years' time? Pretty much the same, I would hope, really. At the moment, I've got a really good sort of work-life balance, probably the best it's ever been. I'd like to be playing
the
piano.
Could you describe that? Because you said earlier that you work 7 days a week.
Yeah.
So what's your best work-life balance look like for you? I just want to understand
that. What it looks like now, I get up early, have a cup of tea, do sort of potter about the house, take my son Magnus to school. He's only 4. So
that's a nice thing to do. I've got my 4-year-old grandson staying. It's such fun.
Oh gosh.
I love it.
And then I go down to Pavilion Road. I see the guys there. We've got a great team. See Kelly and the team. And hey guys, so they make me a double espresso. Then I nip over to Borough. I'll see the team there. See what's in season. See what's on the market. Have a chat to some of the traders. And then sometimes I go up to Wembley. I go to the gym. I have a trainer. I train almost every day. Doing various things on exercise stuff, you know.
Right, that's good. Yeah.
I'm really into that. And it's great. And I like to sort of be back home by sort of mid-afternoon and do some cooking.
Right.
You know.
What do you cook?
Nice risotto, maybe some osso buco, maybe simple steak, you know, just simple food, really, a bit of fish.
That's your evening meal.
Some soup, yeah, and then go to bed at 8:30, 9:00 and right. start all over again.
So you're very visible in the business.
Very, yeah.
You're out there with everyone all the time.
Yeah, I know everyone.
You know everyone, I imagine.
Yeah, I know all the staff, yeah.
That's going to change as it gets bigger and bigger, isn't it?
It will.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'll adapt.
You have to. I mean, it is strange because our company's sort of grown over time and I've gone from knowing pretty much everyone to not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and I think I'm in the best place. Funny. I mean, you know, I'm in the best place I've ever been in my life right now.
Fantastic.
Which is an extraordinary thing because it's been a pretty, pretty turbulent ride at times, you know, and it's really, and I really value the consistency of how I live now. It's really, I really treasure that. And I just don't want to disrupt it too much. So yeah, in 5 years, if it's the same or something close to right now, that'd be great.
So Matthew, under here, I've got a couple of your books.
Yeah.
You're a published author, Bread Ahead, The Expert Home Baker and Baking School, The Bread Ahead Cookbook. Mm. Can I pass them through to you? Tell us about these quickly. So
lovely.
Why did you do books and why would we buy them?
Right. Well, the first one, this was written in 2014, Baking School, The Bread Ahead Cookbook, which was really a way to condense the bakery school, the lessons, into a cookbook. So because it became really clear that the audience we have in the bakery school, you know, they're home bakers and they loved it. They were all asking for a book. So we duly did one. It's a lot of work doing a cookbook. Wow. You know, it's
the photography has to be particularly good, doesn't it?
The whole thing, you know, it's really scientific. The approach, you need a certain, you know, 100 recipes and this and
it, 100 recipes.
Yeah.
Is it that?
So
you didn't do just one, you did two.
Yeah. And then during lockdown, because I wasn't busy enough.
Right.
Let's
okay.
Do another one. Yeah. But I think the, you know, it was really.
So that second one's your lockdown one.
Yeah.
Again, 100 recipes.
Yeah, near about, I think it's 97 or something. And just lots of nice recipes in there. And it's, you know, again, those really, it helps me to sort of reflect on my life because it required a lot of me to do this, you know. And this is the sort of stuff that needs a pretty stable mind. I mean, I wouldn't have done this if I'd been down the pub every 5 minutes, you know.
No.
It needed all of my brain to really focus on to deliver.
Yeah.
And it's such a satisfying thing when it's actually there and done.
It's very nice. I like writing books. I do books as well. And they're like a better than a business card sort of thing. Here's some of our best ideas.
Yeah. It's really solid.
It's sort of recorded somehow in a way that it's for posterity as well. People pick that up in years' time and will enjoy what you've suggested.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people, you know, it's a very giftable thing. And it's just, lovely to do. And it does, again, it's, you know, being an author, you know, I don't really consider myself an author, really, but it's just nice to have
that.
Yes, I suppose it is. I need to
baker and an author. Yeah.
So the Expert Home Baker has been published in other languages, so in Spanish, Dutch, and South Korean.
I had my interview book was translated into South Korean or Korean, and it was 101 interview questions, but they asked if they could take 4 out that weren't culturally appropriate.
Really?
Yeah. One of them was, have you ever stolen a pen from work?
Oh,
that's,
no.
So that's not in there. So I don't. But baking obviously doesn't have this challenge. So you'd be able to keep all of that in. Great. Well,
should we eat a donut?
Yeah, I think we should conclude by eating a donut.
Yeah. Enjoy, James.
Mm.
Bite deep. I'm going to go for the lemon one here. Mmm.
This is fabulous.
Yeah. It's a lot more than just a donut.
I don't know. I don't want to make people too jealous who might be listening, but if you're anywhere near Borough Market, get down there. Thank you very much. This is delicious. Thank you, Matthew, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Matthew, and Bread Ahead, all links are in the show notes.
See you next time.